Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a really exciting show planned for all of you today. Hartman Dietz will be joining me. He is a member of the Wampanoag tribe of Mashpee, and he is an activist and environmentalist, and he's going to talk to us about some of the work that he is doing to protect his land and keep it in within the tribe. And I'm really excited to have him on in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the news, some events coming up that you will definitely want to participate in, and of course, I want to share my weekly recipe with you. So first, what's going on in the news? There's never a boring day. You know, there's a lot of things going on. Right now, on my website, I wrote about the Dicamba weed killer that is put out by DuPont, and it's a top-selling weed killer herbicide that is used amongst farmers, industrial farmers out in the west, Midwest of our country. And just like with Monsanto's GMO seeds, the wind drifted into farmers' land that do not want to be using this herbicide. And there's really a rift going on right now between farmers that use Dicamba's herbicide and those that don't. And the drift is killing the fields of crops that the farmers trying to grow without the herbicides are growing. And it's a real problem. And so we are asking people to, you know, let your voices be heard against this horrible herbicide, and try to participate in keeping the lands free of herbicides and pesticides. And you can do that on my website. I have some petitions you can sign. Also coming out, it will be released this Friday, tomorrow, in theaters, on demand, Amazon, and iTunes, a film called Wasted, The Story of Food Waste. And it's being produced by Anthony Bourdain. It's a new film that is really talking about the problem of food waste, but also some of the exciting solutions that are being thought up between chefs and leaders in the food movement. So there is a hopeful edge to this film, and we're asking everybody to see it because food waste, as you know, is just a huge, huge problem. 40% of the food in this country ends up in a landfill. I'm not kidding, 40%. Think about that. That is just such a huge amount, and the amount of money and resources that are wasted going into that food that is wasted. So it's not only the wasted food, but it's all the resources that went into growing that, producing it, transporting it. It's just a huge, huge atrocity, and so we're trying to get a handle on it. Everybody can participate in this, and we're asking you to check out that film and become aware of this problem of food waste and see how you can be a part of the solution. Also, Pruitt's at his, you know, at his worst again. I guess he's always there. But he is trying to do away with the Clean Power Act that Obama put into, that is supposed to take place coming up, and he is trying to unravel anything that the Obama administration has put in place to reduce carbon emissions and clean up our air, water, and soil. And so the Clean Power Plan was going to require states to meet specific carbon emission reduction standards based on their individual energy consumption. And they also had built into it incentives for states to get a head start on this and to come up with renewable energy plans and energy efficiency. And the EPA estimated that this would save anywhere from 2,700 to 6,600 premature deaths and over 140,000 to 150,000 asthma attacks in children. Excuse me. And on Tuesday, Pruitt put in a motion to repeal this this act. And so we're asking people to please sign the petition. I have it on my website at IE Green to let your voice be heard. We just cannot allow that to happen. You know, we all really have to come together to let our voices be heard. This October 28th, there is a big march that is taking place called the Sandy 5 March. And it is a march in New York City that will start in Brooklyn at the Cadman Plaza, march over the Brooklyn Bridge, and then rally in New York City to let our New York legislators know, our mayor, governor, and everyone else, know that we really want them to be making decisions that will benefit everybody, all the people, not just the corporations on Wall Street. You know, they're doing this big wall that they're planning to keep the waters from surging into Lower Manhattan. But that's great for Lower Manhattan and for Wall Street. But what about everybody else? What about Long Island, Staten Island, the Rockaways? Those are the communities that were impacted worse by Sandy. And we want to remind them and ask them to please, please, to make climate change a priority and to create legislation and create projects that will put people to work who need work to help protect us against the effects of climate change. And it is really difficult when we have people running our country who are still climate deniers. But we really need to come together, and we want to make this a really big march, just like the climate march of 2014 was a huge, huge march, way bigger than anyone expected. We want to make this Sandy 5 march just as big. So please come out for that. You can find out information on my website or go to the Sandy 5 March website, Facebook page, and see how you can get involved. There will be a food and farm contingent as part of this march, and we'll be meeting at Cadman Plaza. Just look for signs of fruits and vegetables, and I'll meet you there. But there's so many ways that you can get involved. We need to rise up and make people power more powerful than the money on Wall Street, and that's not an easy thing to do. We all need to participate in that. So, so on that note, I want to tell you about some things going on in and around the city that are exciting, that are fun ways of participating. There is a New York City Wine and Food Festival going on starting this weekend, October 12th through the 17th, and 100% of all the proceeds that this event raises will go to No Kid Hungry and the Food Bank of New York City. And there's over 80 events to choose from, so you can register online at New York City Wine and Food Festival. And the events are scattered all over the city, so that should be really great. October 12th, there's a food policy for breakfast happening at Hunter College. I believe it's sold out, but you can be on the waiting list. Chef Michael Anthony from Untitled will be there. Lots of other chefs will be there. Charles Plackin will be moderating. He's the executive director of the Hunter College New York City Food Policy Center. And those events are always great. They're up at Hunter College in the Silberman Building. And it's Thursday at 8:30 a.m., and they do provide a nice breakfast along with that. October 13th through the 15th is the Coffee Festival in New York City. And proceeds from this event go to Project Waterfall, which is a project that brings clean water to coffee-producing countries. So it's a way of having fun and having your money go to a good cause at the same time. October 13th, New York SunWorks Learning Center, which I've written about, is a great, great organization that helps bring science focused on sustainability, climate, and food justice issues to New York City schools. They are having a launch party on October 13th. You can register online, and it's at Project Farmhouse, which is a great new space in New York City for a lot of these food events. So you can go onto the SunWorks Learning Center website for more information. October 14th is the farm tour at the Meacock Dairy Farm out in Bridgehampton. And Art Ludlow, who is a cheese maker, will be leading the tour and talking about winemaking. So there's also going to be some wine tasting from Wolfer Estate Vineyards there from, in Sagaponack. So check that out. October 14th, also in the evening, is Outside the Shell, which is an oyster and libation pairing event put on by Edible New York. And that's at the City Pier. So you can register for that online. You can go to the Edible website for that. And also there is a Long Island Harvest event. Benefits of this will go to the Island Harvest Food Bank, and it's at the Crest Hollow Country Club on October 17th. There is a concert also on October 17th that I'm going to. It's a benefit meditation concert by Michel Pascal. Michel Pascal was a guest on my show. He wrote a book for Meditations for Everyday Living, and he recognizes that in this day and age, with all the craziness going on and everyone's busy schedules, many people don't have the time that they can carve out to set aside to sit and meditate, you know, a couple times a day. But he has woven into everyday life how you can meditate while on the subway, while driving, while waiting at a red light, while doing the things that you will be doing anyway, how you can bring a certain consciousness into those activities. And he is also a vocalist and musician, and he will be using music and instruments to help us in this meditation. But this event will also go to benefit using music for cancer patients in hospitals. And so it should be really a wonderful event, and it's going to a good cause. So that's at 8 p.m., and you can buy tickets on the Carnegie Hall website. October 17th also, there's a CUNY Food Policy Forum on Global Food Systems, and that's at the CUNY Graduate School of Public Health. On October 19th, there's the Edible Escape, which is an annual event put on by Edible New York, and it is a tasting event of foods from around the world. It will also take place at the Pier A Harbor House. And these events are really fun. You know, can taste all you want from foods from around the world and not leave Manhattan. So that's a fun event if you'd like to go to that. And October 21st, my local slow food chapter, which I'm sad to say is going to be closing down because I've been running it for the past 8 years, and I'm trying to focus more energy on my cookbook and some other things I have going on. So I'm stepping aside, and I have not found anyone to take over the chapter. So if you know anyone interested in taking over the Slow Food North Shore chapter, please get in touch with me. But in the meantime, we are having our last hurrah, celebrating the Harvest Fest, and it's a farm-to-table celebration. There will be food from many different organic local restaurants, as well as beer from Oyster Bay Brewing Company and wine from Macari Vineyards out on the East End. We have a band from Sparky Team and Richard Cohen and Friends. So there will be live music and dancing. It should be a fun event. And our chapter, since we do have money in the bank, we will be sponsoring the tickets. So the tickets are only $25. And same price for members and non-members alike. So come down, show your support for the slow food movement, and join us in our last hurrah. October 23rd, the James Beard Foundation is having their summit titled Consuming Power. This will be at the Conference Center in New York City. Go on to the James Beard website to find out more information about that. Food Day is coming up on October 24th, and there's lots of events for that. There's a big dance party. When is that? I want to share that with you. That is coming up October... Hold on a second. Garanja Dance Party. Where are you? That is going to be supporting and benefiting Puerto Rico and people that were impacted by the last hurricanes. I'm not seeing it here on my list, but That is a great, oh, here we go. Hold on a second. Here it is, October 16th, Dance for Puerto Rico. This is a big event. They did it a few weeks ago. Food Tank is one of the founders of this big event, and it's partnering with Broadway stars. It's called Carjana, and it is supporting farmers in Puerto Rico. So it's a hurricane relief event, and it's a big dancing party from 5:30 to 7 on October 16th at Union Square Ballroom. This should be fun. You can see a little YouTube screening of it if you just Google Garjana, G-A-R-J-A-N-A. Really fun event and really for a good cause, so check that out. I have lots more events on, but I am not going to go through them for a couple of reasons. One, I feel like I'm starting to lose my voice, as you can hear, but also I want to share with you my recipe and invite Hartman Dietz on. So this is the recipe of this week. I made a butternut squash coconut curry, and I still have so many butternut squash coming out of the garden, so I will continue to share butternut squash recipes that I'm creating as I work through my butternut squash. So this was delicious. Check it out. I used two medium-sized butternut squash, a tablespoon of coconut oil, 1 teaspoon of finely chopped fresh ginger root, 1 teaspoon of finely chopped garlic. Now, I would have used more fresh ginger root, but I didn't have any, and I didn't want to run out, so I did use 2 teaspoons of powdered ginger. But feel free, if you have more fresh ginger, to use more fresh ginger and delete the 2 teaspoons of powdered ginger. I also used 1 onion sliced into crescent moons, 1 cup of finely chopped potatoes, which pretty much almost disappeared and became just a thickening agent for the curry. 2 cayenne peppers, 1 long Jamaican green pepper, 1 teaspoon salt, 1/2 teaspoon coriander, 2 teaspoons cardamom, 2 teaspoons cumin, 1/2 teaspoon turmeric, 1/2 teaspoon garam masala, 1 tablespoon of fresh coriander, that's the same as cilantro, and I also kept a little aside for the garnish, 1 can of coconut milk, and my cayenne peppers were not that spicy, so I actually added 1/4 teaspoon of cayenne pepper at the end because I want a little bit more spice, but that will be up to you to decide how spicy you want your dish. So I used a medium stainless steel pot for this. I started by sauteing the onions into coconut oil with the fresh garlic and the fresh ginger just for a few minutes. Then I added the butternut squash, the peppers and the potatoes, and all of the spices. And I just wanted the spices to brown a little bit in the oil and coat the vegetables before I added the water. I added a little bit of a cup of water to this, 1.5 cups of water actually, which I realized I did not list here in the ingredients. But I added 1.5 cups of water, and I let that come to a boil, and then I reduced the heat to a simmer, stirred well, and covered it, and let the pot simmer for about 10 minutes, stirring occasionally, making sure the bottom's not sticking. Then I added the coconut milk, the garam masala, and the fresh coriander, and cooked for about 5 more minutes. And I tasted it just to adjust the spices, but I didn't have to, but you can adjust them to your tastings. And then I garnished it with a little more fresh coriander, and I served it with some basmati rice. And it was just delicious, really fresh flavored, not too spicy, a little sweetness to it just from the butternut squash. I don't add any sugar or sweetener at all. And it was really great. So enjoy that recipe, and please let me know how you like it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest, Hartman Dietz. He is a member of the Wampanoag tribe of Mashpee. He's recently returned to Mashpee, Massachusetts, after spending 7 years in Hoochelon Olon territory, which is in the Oakland, Richmond, California area. And during his time in California, Hartman was an active part of the Idle No More San Francisco Bay chapter, And the Idle No More is an environmentalist and Native American group that's focused on issues of environmental and social justice. And as a member of this group, Deets organized with Native communities and allies against the Glen Cove development, which is right here on Long Island, that many of my friends are part of, the Kinder Morgan project, the Keystone XL pipeline, and the Chevron refinery protests. And Deets was part of the creation of the Refinery Corridor Healing Walks in 2014, which highlighted the connected struggles of five refineries and the communities that they impact along a 40-mile stretch of the San Francisco Bay. And Deets also came to that People's Climate March in 2014 that I mentioned before, and he also traveled to North Dakota three times to participate in the Standing Rock protests. And Deets also is a educator. He's taught for 4 years in the Wampanoag language program and as a teacher at the Oakland Decolonize Academy, which is an independent school focusing on quality, relevant, and realistic education to black and brown youth. He's also presented at various colleges on panels in eight different states and contributed recently to the book Land Justice, Reimagining Land, Food, and the Commons in the United States. And that's actually where I met Deets, and I'm so happy to have him on. So, Hartman, are you with me?
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hello. I'm doing well. How are you? Thanks for having me on this morning.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us. So, first, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself? I know you have a BA in Cultural Education and Community Sustainability. What does that actually mean?
Well, you know, as a Wampanoag person, we are, you know, the people on Cape Cod, Massachusetts, and we are the original people of Thanksgiving. You know, so we're actually in our own homeland, which is not the typical story for most Native American people and a lot of people around the world. And I went to school asking myself the question, you know, being a Wampanoag person and being surrounded by so many economic and cultural forces put on us, asking us to assimilate and become a part of the melting pot, how do we stay our own people in our own homeland? And how do we maintain our culture and existence into the future? And, you know, there's a lot of things that go into that. And one of the main things, it seems to me, that perpetuates our culture and our community into the future is being able to educate our people about, you know, what the expectations that it is to be a Wampanoag person, what the expectations are to how we treat each other as a community and how we conduct ourselves in the world. But then as well, the community sustainability aspect is what are the things that you functionally need to live and continue to be a community and a culture. And you know, that has to do with food sovereignty, that has to do with land justice, that has to do with economic development. So all of these things come into play when it's a matter of being able to remain a people in our homeland.
Uh-huh. And I mentioned earlier that you are teaching Wampanoag language. Do you have your own language? Now, was the language lost for some while and then is re-coming back, or have the Wampanoag people been able to maintain their language throughout time?
We weren't able to maintain it as a full fluent language throughout, but it's always remained in words and phrases, not complete, you know, interactions. But we were also, as first contact people, taught the tools of reading and writing very early on in the 1630s and 1640s. There was more Wampanoag people literate in Wampanoag within New England than there were English people literate in English. So there we have the whole Bible translated into Wampanoag. We have a lot of wills, deeds, letters back and forth, different communications that we're able to draw from and pair it with the continuous spoken form of it to really make a full language reclamation project. And we have had over 500, I believe, students come through our project at this point in time, or I should say the project at this point in time. I haven't worked with them for a few years, but it's an amazing project. It's one of the few examples of functional language restoration that has brought back conversational level speaking of a language that had otherwise been in serious remission.
The first Terra Madre I went to, which is the slow food every other year event that happens in Italy, there was the theme was language, actually, and bringing back languages to indigenous tribes around the world, from, you know, Eskimos and, you know, Australians and, you know, the indigenous people of so many different areas. Was the Wampanoag at all part of that slow food project, or is this something you're doing independently on your own?
This is something that was begun independently on our own. There's a great film, As Natayanyan, We Are Still Here, and it highlights the story of our language reclamation project. There have been some efforts by people who had an interest in cultural history and the fact that there are so many documents out there. There was some efforts that had existed previous to Jesse Littledoe taking on a very wholehearted effort. But she began to have dreams where people were speaking to her in Wampanoag and felt that this was something that called to her, that she felt was her life's work to help revitalize the language. And so this was something that happened in 1993, I believe, and this is really the beginning of a very organized effort to not just learn words and phrases or how to say the Lord's Prayer or, you know, to translate on paper, but to actually make a language reclamation project where people were using the language and conversing with each other. So this is something that's been a long time in the works.
Uh-huh. Very exciting.
It is.
Now, you mentioned you were there for the first Thanksgiving, or your people were there for the first Thanksgiving. What did they actually eat at the first Thanksgiving?
Well, as Wampanoag people, we are associated with the big meal, the big American meal, right? Since we're talking food. And it's funny because we're often called the Indians, and we don't even get name recognition in this. So we were there. Wampanoag people were there. Wampanoag people were the Indians. And we have today, we come together oftentimes, American families all over, and have turkey and pumpkin pie, but neither one of those things were probably on the menu that year.
I doubt it, right?
Yeah, for one, pumpkin pie hadn't been invented yet. It was a new, it was something that had been unheard of. Pumpkin itself is a Wampanoag word. It was something that was a new item to the English people. They didn't have a name for it in their language, so they went to the people who had a name for it and referred to it as that. And pumpkin, or pompkin in Wampanoag, is our word, and it's a borrowed word in English. So, it's something that became adapted into the culinary of America and the world with the mixing of cultures, the crust and then the filling and all that is definitely a fusion between two worlds. Folks probably had goose or duck rather than turkey. The historical record talks about four men being sent out fowling in the grasses along the river, and that's certainly more where you find waterfowl rather than turkey. Massasoit Usamequin sent men into the woods, and they came back with two deer, so venison would have been on the menu. They probably would have had fish. The fish was a big part of the diet for people in the summertime then, and into the fall, into the change of the seasons, because at that point in time, you were still everybody in the world, not just native people, but the whole world had to rely on the natural cycles and rhythms of what food had to offer. There's no refrigeration at this point in time, so you couldn't keep meat in the summertime. You had to worry about what you could consume before it went rotten, and the health of the animals themselves when they were harvested and butchered. So these things were a part of how everybody ate, and you wouldn't have had beef on the menu, you wouldn't have had pork, you wouldn't have had a lot of the different things that I think have sort of become a part of the standard. But we probably played football or an Indian football game as well. So that was a part of the tradition even back then that seems to have carried on now into today, which is interesting.
I had heard that when the Europeans first came over to America, that there were over 200 varieties of wild turkeys that lived here, you know, and now we're down to like Butterball, you know. I mean, you know, that's why there's this whole movement of bringing back heritage turkeys, because we've lost so much of our biodiversity in not just crops, but in livestock as well. So, you know, I was wondering, just thinking that was maybe one of those wild turkeys was there as well. But you're saying no, probably a goose or duck or wild fowl was the bird on the table.
Yeah, something that swims in the water. But,
right.
Yeah, it's incredible how much biodiversity we've lost overall and how much general diversity we've lost. You know, it's one of the things we struggle with as Wampanoag people is we're part of a diversity that's being erased as well. And as we know from, you know, stock portfolios and from, you know, crop production and from so many other things, that diversity really is a strength to be able to adapt to new and changing situations. So it's really a shame that we are so quick to try to, you know, monocrop and to, you know, and to try to come up with a monoculture, really, of assimilation and this practice where there's only one way to be, one way to think, one way to eat, one way to live. And a lot of the way that's being pushed forward is not necessarily healthy for us and for the planet. And it's certainly tied in with monocrop big fields of corn for as far as the eye can see, and the fact that we don't have the many varieties of turkeys that we once did, and that, you know, we don't have as many different varieties of grasses and all these other things that are happening on the planet.
Right, right. Now, the Pilgrims, when they came over, they didn't know how to grow corn, right? Can you share with us, you know, the history of corn and how that came to be, and the Wampanoag people taught the Pilgrims how to grow corn?
Certainly. Corn is a new world crop, as they call it, and it's something that originates from Mexico, and it feeds so much of the world today. It's something that was developed by indigenous science, indigenous thinkers, indigenous agroeconomists that took this wild grass and changed it into an edible plant that could sustain communities. It's very attached to native people throughout the continents of North and South America, and a lot of our stories of changing in the world to times of hunger and times of struggle to sustain ourselves. And when corn comes along, it guarantees food for the people. And these stories have different variations throughout, but oftentimes, you know, they share this common thread. So when the English folks came over from England, they had never seen corn as a crop before. This was something that was new to them, just like pumpkin, just like skunks, just like so many other things of this world, like turkeys. And they didn't know how to plant crop. And a lot of the people that came over here were actually urban people in England, being pushed out. So these weren't necessarily farmers that were coming over. They were coopers and ministers and people with other skills other than farming. And so these folks, for one, they needed to learn how to work the land at all, but then they also had to learn how to grow this new crop altogether. And for Native people, you know, we had Squanto, who came amongst them. He had lived in England and had been a slave and had a very tragic life story. But you know, he was a character in our history that has a lot of good and bad in him for our story. But regardless of all that, he shows them how to plant corn. He shows them how to fertilize the ground with fish, which was something new to the thinking and the worldview of European farming at that point in time. And he also shows them something called companion planting now, where you have different plants that work together to help each other. And this is also a native innovation, a native, you know, thinking on farming and growing food, where you grow the corn and the beans and the squash together. And for us, right, we often have the story of the three sisters who come and they all help each other to grow, and they all can grow more out of the same space than if you grew any one of them alone, as we're talking about monocropping. But of course you can't harvest, you know, you can't harvest them all together with a big combine machine. So, you know, the industrial system doesn't like it, but the fact of the matter is that you'll get a much greater yield out of a smaller piece of ground if you put all these plants together. The beans put nitrogen in the soil that the other plants need. The corn grows straight up and climbs up towards the sun and provides a pole for the beans to climb. The squash spreads out along the ground and shades the soil, keeps smaller weeds from coming up, and helps keep the moisture locked in. So all these things together, they all help to create a system of interdependence that's really fundamental to a lot of the thinking from Native perspective about the world in general, not just crops, but, you know, humanity and our way that we play our role in the world in relation to turkeys and to the rivers and into the land we live on and the other animals and living beings that we share it with. So this thinking of interdependence is a fundamental part that I think is really lacking in the world that we have today.
It is, but I have to say that, and I know you know this, that the wisdom of the Native people is coming back in the regenerative movement and the permaculture movement, and people that are trying to go back to more of the natural ways, using the wisdom of the Native people in protecting our land and taking care of the soil. And, you know, it's a wonderful movement that I know you're a part of and I'm a part of, and there is hope. But before we continue, we need to take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, I want to talk more about the Wampanoag territory and some of the issues that you're dealing with your land there and protecting it with your land rights, et cetera. So everyone, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Hartman Dietz from the Wampanoag tribe, and you're listening to Bhavani and I Eat Green. We'll be right back.
We are PRN, Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned.
It's the BRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul. And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
Stay tuned for more news you can use on PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm talking with Hartman Dietz, my guest today from the Wampanoag Tribe. He's an artist, educator, and activist, and we're talking about the work he's doing supporting his tribe and the people and the land that they live on. So, Hartman, are you with me?
Yes.
Great. So when I met you at the launch party for that wonderful book, you were sharing some stories of the issues and the struggles that you're having in protecting the land that you're actually living on that belongs to your people, and some of the backhanded finagling that the government's doing to try to not give you the rights that you are entitled to. Can you share with us a little bit of the struggle you're going through right now?
Certainly. And, you know, I think it's important to sort of preface this with there's oftentimes a thought that the rights and legal standings that Native people have somehow derive from the United States giving these rights to us. But it's important to understand in this that we are the original people of the land. And so any rights that we have are rights that we have always had and always held on to. The rights that we have given up are the rights that we no longer have as to ourselves as a people. So this is an important thing to understand, because there's a lot of these things where they will argue that we are somehow asking for some kind of unfair advantage or some kind of, you know, extra special treatment from the country to give these things to us. But yet, fact of the matter is that we are where we have always been. We are continuously on our own homeland. And we have been here since before these laws and since before these governments and before these institutions have come here and tried to limit our freedoms and our ability to interact with the world as the way that we should. So,
right.
Yeah, as Wampanoag people, we are here. We are the people who met the pilgrims. We have been here continuously. I live on a two-acre piece of land that's never been owned by a white man ever, in spite of the fact of being, you know, 400 years close to colonization. So these are facts that are important to the whole of it. We, as a tribe, were systematically broken down after King Philip's War. You know, there was 70 communities of Wampanoag people when the English landed here, and now there are 5 communities of Wampanoag people, and we are trying desperately to hold on to what we still have and maintain a control over what's still ours. And in doing this, we have to find ways and means to do this in today's world. So we were forced to become a town and forced to become citizens in the 1860s against our will. We voted it down twice and then were made a town and made citizens in spite of those votes. And in, you know, we, for the 1860s to the 1960s or so, we ran the town, we ran the police, the fire, the town hall, all the different positions of the town were run by Wampanoag people. But then in the 1960s, the demographics of the town started to change. A lot of wealthy people came and started buying up all the waterfront and putting up, you know, McMansions or, you know, wealthy houses and elite houses along the waterfront. This caused rifts at this point in time because our people have always gone to the bay traditionally to fish and get our sustenance. This is such an intricate part of who we are. People didn't live along the edge of the water because hurricanes come in and, you know, storms come in. It's just not a good place to live. And the bay, we have always seen the bay is for everybody. It's not for any one person. It's for everybody to use and enjoy, and everybody needs to get to it and have access to it. So struggles began when these wealthy people started to try to privatize the beaches and privatize access to water, something that we have Aboriginal rights to. We have rights to access our, native food ways the way we always have, our means of sustaining ourselves that we always have. This is fundamental to being able to continue as a people. So when these things happened and these issues came up, we sued for land and were denied the ability to be the plaintiff on account of whether or not there was some doubt as to whether we were a tribe and whether we were Indian people. And so this happened in the 1970s, and at that point in time, we filed our petition for federal recognition. In 1974, I believe, we filed our suit, and it systematically was backlogged until we got casino investors to grease the wheels, to pay the lobbyists. I guess some people call them lobbyists, some people call them bribes. It's really just a legal system of bribery. So we had to bribe the courts to get our case heard, and when our case was finally heard, it was 2007, and we were finally acknowledged by the United States that tells our Thanksgiving tale over and over again that we are actually Indians. So they acknowledge that we're Indians now. And at this point in time, we started to try to pursue our rights to economic development, to access our land for hunting and fishing, for even just to get to the cranberry bogs, to get to the woods for different kinds of medicines, for places that we have ceremony. There's been a big issue lately where they've been blocking off our ancient roads, our old dirt roads, with big iron gates to control where we can move. And this is also a violation of not only our Aboriginal rights, but our treaty rights. So there's a constant sort of back and forth with the town and with different, jurisdictions that want to impose their will on us as a people, but don't have the fundamental right to do that, because, as I said before, it comes back to the fact that we are in our homeland, and these are rights that we have not ever given up to anybody else. So, they would have to take these rights from us at this point. So it's not a matter of them granting us any rights. It's a matter of what rights are they taking from us. So with the fact that we needed money to grease the wheels of justice, we have gotten in bed with casino investors. And at this point in time, we are $400 million in debt, I believe, or $500 million in debt. We're deep in debt and have yet to see the first brick laid in the casino. This has been, an issue that has been persisting for years and years, to try to find us a way where we can have our rights acknowledged and have our rights respected and be able to live in a very small chunk of our once very large homeland as Wampanoag people. If we were animals, we would probably have more rights to be protected under the Endangered Species Act to protect our habitat than we are as Native people to be able to try to hold our communities together. So we move these things forward, and with the change of administration into the Trump administration, they have decided to try a lot of reorganizing, and of course with great support from the oil industry and fracking industry and all these other fossil fuels, that they want to be able to take Indian land. They want to be able to abrogate treaties, which are actually agreements between sovereign governments, nation-to-nation agreements. They are the supreme law of the land. And they want to be able to unilaterally, from one side, decide to change the agreements. And this is happening again and again. This is the same story that has continued since the Mayflower landed. They want to be able to change the laws to suit whatever they want to take from us, and never what we need to gain for ourselves. So they are seeking now to change the laws to take our land out of trust, so that we cannot develop it economically, as a tribal governmental entity. This is a process. Land into trust is also a pretty racist process as well, where the federal government takes the Indian tribal land and holds it in trust on our behalf because we are incapable of taking good care of our land because we don't know what's best for ourselves. And so the government sees fit to hold it in trust on our behalf, you know, which is just, you know, clearly racist that, you know, we are taking care of our own things. I feel like half the problems we're in is because we leave it to somebody who has no vested interest in our continued survival to take care of us. So now that we have land into trust, we've been acknowledged as a tribe, our tribal federal interactions are cemented, and our land is, you know, deemed as a trust status land. Now they are seeking ways to take this land out of trust, and they are actually trying to invent new laws, because this is a process that has never before happened, ever. So, you know, and their justification for this is that we are seeking special treatment. So, you know, the idea that somehow we're seeking special treatment and that we are, you know, using a process that has been in place for, you know, decades and has been, you know, replicated in different places in Indian country throughout, you know, the United States. And yet we are seeking special treatment because we want to be able to approve our own buildings with our own governmental agencies, with our own engineers, with our, with our own right to economic development, you know, and if the state of Massachusetts, you know, who wants to impose their will on our land, you know, was to try to impose their will on the state of Rhode Island, I think that everybody would be in an uproar and say they were overstepping their bounds. But when they want to impose their will on a tribal government, you know, we are trampled underfoot. And this is what we're looking at right now. So they're trying to invent a new process of law to take our land out of trust, so that we have to fall under a state jurisdiction of some kind or another. And, you know, it's clearly, the hypocrisy is just so clear that, you know, these laws are only meant to hold us down and never meant to bring us up. And these laws are conditionally changed when we do find a way to work with them and lift ourselves up. They change the rules again so that we are once again disadvantaged, so that they can have what they want from us. And this is a story that's repeated again and again and again. The details change, but those basic facts of the narrative are continued again and again throughout Indian country, and it's a terrible thing to see.
So, Hartman, can you share with us, is there anything that those of us listening and those of us that are sympathetic to the struggles of your people, what can we do to help? Is there anything?
Well, one of the organizations that I work with is the Native Land Conservancy, and we are a group of Wampanoag people that are seeking to create land conservancy, conservation land throughout our territory. And you can find more information at nativelandconservancy.org. That is the website. And and what we are trying to do is trying to acquire land, for one. And this way, by having it as a nonprofit, we can, you know, oftentimes operate in ways that are not as tied down with the tribal government and their ability to assert their jurisdiction. Whatever we can just conservation land, we can set stipulations on conservation and what kind of uses we can have for the land. We're also working in conjunction with some of these other land conservation organizations and trying to gain access and special use for sustainable harvesting or sustainable forestry practices that are actually very helpful at times to have in place in different land and different environments, because, you know, the human hand is always, for a very, very long time, it's always been a part of shaping the world that we live in. And, And sometimes these environments really could use some help. And to thin out a cedar grove actually gives, you know, if you cut one out of three trees and the other two will get healthier from it, it's a lot different than going in and clear cutting all the trees, you know.
Sure.
And the same thing can be true with hunting and fishing practices, where, you know, if you take on these practices with the idea of not just, you know, gathering as much resource as you can to exploit the resource, but taking what you need from the resource and trying to help and assist this resource to perpetuate itself, you know, it can be very helpful for the land and, mm-hmm. and very, you know, a very good thing to have a human interaction as opposed to just entirely hands-off approach to not touching a piece of land and doing nothing with it, where things can get overgrown and become hazardous with fire, you know, a fire hazard with too much underbrush, or to have ponds get choked up with algae, or to, you know, to help seed shellfish out into the shellfish beds, which will help clean up the water quality and, you know, all the different impacts that can happen along with this. So,
right.
So we're looking to get agreements with different land conservations that exist as well to be able to go into these areas and use the land in this way.
Well, Harmon, we're just about out of time. So can you just share, do you have a website for the Wampanoag people or Facebook page where people can just stay in touch?
For my tribe, you can reach my tribe. It's the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe .net.
Okay.
And that's our tribal website. And you can certainly keep up with the developments that are happening as far as the big news that happens there. We have a newsletter that comes out every month and talks about some of the things that are happening in the tribal government and the tribal programs.
Right, well, I'll share both those links for the nativelandconservancy.org and the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe.net on my website so people can find it. And I just want to thank you so much for joining me on the show. It's been eye-opening, and it's such important information for us to, you know, to understand the struggles. And, you know, I think, you know, the more white people that become sympathetic to your cause, hopefully we can be somewhat helpful.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Everybody out there listening, thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at iegreen.com. And I've been talking with Hartman Dietz. Thank you, Hartman.